from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey everyone, it's 4 o'clock in New York. I'm Alicia Menendez, in for Nicole Wallace, as we monitor the heightened state of alert in Washington, D.C., following a warning from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security that extremists have discussed plans to, quote, take control of the U.S. Capitol and remove Democratic lawmakers. Today, an increased presence from law enforcement surrounding the Capitol building, police on guard for pro-Trump conspiracy theorists who believe today, March 4th, should be Donald Trump's rightful inauguration day, and who police say are motivated to mount an attack. National Guard troops seen descending on the Capitol this morning, a dramatic expression of how the country and the response from law enforcement has changed since January 6th, when, according to testimony from the National Guard's commander, General William Walker, it took more than 3 hours to get approval for troops to move to the scene. And news today suggests that the elevated state of alert will remain for weeks to come. Two defense officials telling NBC News that the Department of Defense has received a request from U.S. Capitol Police for continued support from the National Guard. President Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, speaking out today about the scope of the threat and efforts by the new administration to defend against it in an exclusive interview with our own Jacob Soboroff.
One of the greatest threats that we face in the homeland is the rise of domestic violent extremism. And one of our responsibilities in the department is to ensure that we're disseminating intelligence and information to our state and local law enforcement partners and to the communities so that we can equip the communities to guard against this growing threat. We are watching the threat stream, the information, social media, other sources with respect to this particular day, March 4th. But quite frankly, we are vigilant every day as we must be when the threat is as acute as it is in the domestic violent extremism context.
We should point out that according to federal law enforcement, the acute threat Secretary Mayorkas describes didn't develop in a vacuum. And FBI and DHS officials warned that the kinds of militias who pose a threat to the Capitol today were emboldened by the January 6th attack and therefore now pose a greater security threat overall. That's right. The same insurrection fueled by Donald Trump's big lie about the election result that killed 5 Americans and put the lives of lawmakers and their staffs in danger continues to inspire and motivate would-be domestic terrorists right now, which makes it all the more significant that some of the Republicans whose rhetoric helped to incite the January 6th rioters in the first place continue to amplify disinformation about election security, like former Vice President Mike Pence, who yesterday, on the eve of a credible threat to the Capitol building, linked to the riot that left him and his family fleeing for their lives, published an op-ed railing against so-called irregularities in the 2020 election, despite overwhelming evidence and under oath testimony from the nation's top law enforcement officials affirming Joe Biden's win. With members of the Republican Party stoking a threat to national security, that's where we start today. Here to talk about all of it, Eugene Daniels is here, White House reporter, co-author of Politico's Playbook. Also with us, Zolan Cannon Youngs, White House reporter for The New York Times, and former Republican Congressman Carlos Corbello of Florida, an MSNBC contributor. But we start first with MSNBC's Yasmin Vesuvian live outside the Capitol complex. Yasmin, tell us about the heightened state of alert on the ground in Washington. What are you seeing?
It's really high, Alicia. Good to see you, by the way. I was here on January 6th. I was here on Inauguration Day as well. On January 7th, after the insurrection, we saw these gates behind me, these walls behind me. Let's move over here a little bit. These things were being erected, right? They were being built up on January 7th. That barbed wire on top beginning to be put in place as well. This was all in place, obviously, for Inauguration Day. We saw a lot of this footage. You see some of the National Guard just inside that gate as well. But there is certainly a sense of heightened security here on the east side of the Capitol. If we can push in on the east side of the steps of the Capitol there as well. I mean, all along this, it really is somewhat, Alicia, of a fortified green zone because of this heightened threat for this date on March 4th. And it's incredibly credible threat. I mean, you think about the idea of the chief of the Capitol Hill Police essentially saying just over the last 2 months, there has been an increase of 90% in threats against members of Congress. Think about that number. 90% increase just over the last 2 months. On top of that, you have the FBI director, Chris Wray, saying this didn't begin on January 6th. And it did not end on January 6th. And defense officials, they didn't want to be caught flat-footed today if, in fact, something did happen the way that they were on January 6th. And you think about overall, right, the overarching view here is this. I've reported a lot overseas in the Middle East specifically in the fortified zones that are around federal buildings and embassies there. This is where we are now, here in this country, in the United States of America. I am in front of the Capitol on the east side looking at a fortified green zone. You talk about the Defense Department that's sitting on the request from the Capitol for National Guard to be in place for months to come, possibly. The question really is, how long is this going to be in place? How long do D.C. residents, do Americans in general, and do members of Congress have to deal with the security threat that persists throughout this country because of the increase of domestic terrorism and the threats from domestic terrorist groups that we've been seeing throughout the country? This is the world we live in right now, Alicia, and it's concerning across the board.
All right, Yasmin Vesuvian reporting from us for us from outside the Capitol. Yasmin, thank you. Zolan, what we are watching at the Capitol, what Yasmin was just showing us, it's happening in the shadow of January 6th. Compare today's law enforcement response to what we saw on January 6th, when officials were worried about a National Guard presence at the Capitol, even though the chatter law enforcement was picking up around today was less intense than what they saw before January 6th.
I talked to, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, even just the fact that now we're seeing an intelligence warning go out about this online chatter. It'll be interesting to see what this says about intelligence sharing and information sharing in the days ahead. I talked to an administration official yesterday about that bulletin, who said that given what we saw in the days and the lack of warnings that we saw in the days before January 6th, all of that went into issuing the DHS joint bulletin with the FBI yesterday. And there were some interesting things in that warning besides just the fact that extremists were coming in on March 4th. Once again, this is another intelligence warning saying that we are in an elevated threat environment. Mm-hmm. There was another one that was issued in late January saying that same thing, that extremists continue to be emboldened, not just by the conspiracy theories of QAnon and what have you online, but also still by false statements around the election, that extremists continue to be emboldened by that as well. And really just interesting and scary details as well, the fact that people were talking about online about targeting lawmakers at the Capitol. But what will be interesting is how intelligence officials and the federal government really balance homing in and issuing warnings based off of chatter that is protected by the First Amendment online, and discerning through that chatter what is actually a threat. That's something law enforcement has always struggled with, so it'll be interesting to see where they go forward with that.
Eugene, let's pick up on something that Zolan just said, which is I want to remind everyone why today, March 4th, matters. Supporters of the QAnon conspiracy theory have set March 4th as the date that they believe former President Donald Trump will return to office. Obviously, that is not going to happen. I would ask how these theories stay alive, but we know that it is at least in part because Trump allies in the GOP continue to give these types of conspiracies life by continuing to lie about the election result. What responsibility, then, do they have for what we're watching today at the Capitol?
they have a huge responsibility to tell these people to stop, right? Like, the thing about QAnon and these conspiracy theories is that it's always based on a date, right? There was the date, there was the, you have the actual election, and then you have the time in between the Electoral College. They have the Electoral College, like, every day, January 6th, you had January 20th, all of these dates where Trump was supposed to become victorious. And today, March 4th, because after 1933, before 1933, rather, that is when presidents were sworn in. So that's where that date came from. And the at this point, it feels like everything seems fine, you know, with what happened, and everyone's kind of calm. But how does the GOP convince people that this lie is a lie, even now, when the former president of the United States stands in front of CPAC, repeats that same thing, repeats the fact that he says that the election was stolen from him, which we know is not true, and the crowd starts chanting, "You won," over and over, right? This is in the party in a way that it feels like it's going to be hard for them to pull that out. And I'm not sure how the Republican Party deals with that when you have people like Ron Johnson, the Senator Ron Johnson, kind of still pushing these conspiracy theories in these hearings. And so the party has to have a completely different conversation around it. And it's hard to do when former President Trump is the leader of their party still.
Right, Carlos, you convinced the base that it was a lie by coming out and saying that it was a lie. Where's the accountability from Republicans? Yes, you have Representative McCaul, a Republican from Texas, saying that Trump has a responsibility to tell potential Capitol attackers to stand down. But beyond that, I mean, where are Republicans? What are they afraid of?
Alicia, the images that we're seeing, what our country is experiencing, is the long tail of the big lie told by Donald Trump, the many lies told by Donald Trump, and the refusal by too many Republicans to confront and condemn those lies. And you pointed out earlier, former Vice President Pence, someone whose safety, whose security was at risk on the 6th of January, someone who some of the invaders stated they wanted to attack and perhaps even murder. He writes an op-ed that at best excuses President Trump's lie and at worst advances and promotes it. Some Republicans have stepped up, have spoken for the truth, Liz Cheney, Mitch McConnell, Adam Kinzinger, and others, but too many continue refusing to confront these lies and to tell their voters that this is completely made up, that there's no basis in fact for it. And this is a short-term strategy because they don't want to get crossways with former President Trump. But long-term, it is a losing strategy because lies are corrosive and eventually they consume everyone, including the people who excuse and promote them.
I mean, Zolan, here's the thing. This is not a one-and-done deal. Yesterday's testimony from officials at DHS, the FBI, DOD, the Washington, D.C. National Guard, they all unanimously agreed that the January 6th attack emboldened domestic extremists. Take a listen.
We do assess that the breach on the Capitol could inspire others to act.
I agree. Anytime an adversary is successful, others pay attention. And so we're worried that this would be an inspiration.
I agree with that.
Zolan, I agree as well, sir.
Zolan, would be an inspiration, given that reality, given those stakes, how does law enforcement take into account the fact that the disinformation isn't just coming from some far reaches of the internet, it's coming from Republican members of the House and Senate?
No, it's an incredible challenge, as you just said. I mean, we've had numerous now public warnings coming out from these federal agencies that are saying over and over again that the continued false statements about the election, a clear reference to former President Trump, continues to embolden these extremists. And now it has led to an environment where we have an elevated threat from domestic extremists, including the more lethal threat of how the FBI director described it, racially motivated extremists, racist extremists, and specifically white supremacists. So at this point, if you're law enforcement right now, the Biden administration is doing a government-wide review about how they combat these threats. They're examining DHS as well as DHS's intelligence branch, which faced a lot of backlash last year. You have the FBI that's now, I believe Christopher Wray said that his investigations since he came into office in 2017 have doubled to about 2,000. They're hoping that by being public about that investigative work, it will have a chilling effect and discourage some of these extremists that may have been emboldened or were emboldened by January 6th. So we'll have to see how that investigative work plays out.
Eugene Daniels, I don't know if you got a chance to read all of former Vice President Pence's piece in the Daily Signal, but it really was a cornucopia of lies. So let's fact check some of his claims about Democrats' voting rights bill. He claims that it bans voter ID. It does not. He claims it registers undocumented immigrants to vote in federal elections, one of their favorite boogeymen. It does not. He claims it requires counting of ballots mailed after Election Day. It does not. I mean, Eugene, what's the tell here? What are they so afraid of?
The thing that you're hearing, and we heard that this week when the Supreme Court heard a case about elections, is that he said the quiet part out loud, that this would put them at a competitive disadvantage, allowing everyone to have the right to vote. And I talked with Tom Emmer, the head of the NRCC, in a playbook event earlier this week, and something he even zeroed in on this HR1 bill. He kept bringing up the fact that it was socializing in the way of word of socialism, socializing the way that we do elections in this country. And that is such a small part of it. But you're hearing this from Republicans over and over, because what former President Trump did, and I don't think he did it on purpose, is that the lie that he created fed into something that Republicans have wanted to do for years, which is restrict voting rights in this country in different places for different people. And something that we are seeing now is that after they have this quote unquote evidence from President Trump and these complaints from him, that's based on a lie, they can now run around the country making different laws and saying that they're doing this in the minds of election integrity because millions of people think the election was stolen and that needs to be taken care of. But what they're not saying, and when you ask them about, they squirm around it, is that former President Trump created this lie. Right. So it wasn't something that millions of people were thinking independently. He told them that it was stolen. And so now we're going to see, and we're already seeing, hundreds of different bills that are going to restrict voting rights in this country in different ways, whether that's less mail-in voting, no voting on the weekends, all of these different types of things. And that is something the Republican Party has been doing for years. And now they have even more ammunition and fodder to do it with.
Carlos, and we know who those efforts hit the hardest. They hit Latino voters, they hit Black voters, and they hit young voters. Is that then a concession on the part of a lot of these Republicans that they cannot win over those voters with persuasive arguments or policies, and this is the best that they've got?
Well, Alicia, yes, in many ways, Republicans are saying, well, we want to make it more difficult for people to vote. And I've told Republicans for many years, you're the only business owners who want fewer people to show up. Most of the time, people want to invite as many people as possible in. This is a short-term strategy that is doomed to fail. And the other thing I want to say, Alicia, this op-ed by Vice President Pence, let me translate it for you. This is an apology to the Trump base. The vice president knows that his numbers among Trump supporters dropped considerably because he refused to do what the president asked him to do, which is basically to steal the election. So now, rather than telling these base voters the truth and explaining to them why he did not reject the votes cast by the American people in November of 2020, rather than doing that, he's apologizing for not being absolutely loyal to the former president. Again, this is a short-sighted strategy because a party cannot survive on lies.
Eugene Daniels, Zolencano Youngs, Carlos Curbelo, thank you for starting us off. When we come back, it's been headline after headline that is giving many people hope that we can return to some kind of normalcy in just a few short months. But this comes as new coronavirus infections are creeping back up near where we were during the most recent summer surge. It's the real story. And breaking overnight, Florida's Republican governor under fire again for his handling of the pandemic. This time, the criticism surrounding how the state is allocating vaccines and if he's playing favorites based on political donations. The reporter who broke that story joins us. Plus, more from the Biden administration's new Secretary of Homeland Security, who sat down exclusively with MSNBC's Jacob Soboroff. We'll hear what he had to say on the growing number of unaccompanied children in U.S. custody. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after this.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Over the last 7 days or so, we've reached a bit of a plateau where the deflection of the curve isn't going straight down the way it was. That's a bad sign. We've seen that before. We're going in the right direction. Now's the time to keep the foot on the accelerator and not pull off, because the thing that we don't want is yet again another surge.
After 5 weeks of a decline in new infections from a very high place, the United States is now where we were at the height of the summer surge last year, about 63,000 new COVID cases per day. Fauci's warning came with a promising prediction of some signs of normality by the fall, thanks to increasing vaccinations. But at the same time, several states threaten this because our fourth wave by ditching measures meant to protect us. The latest from another Republican, Alabama's governor, announcing the state's mask mandate will end no matter what on April 9th. One day after the Republican governors of Texas and Mississippi ended theirs. Decisions made despite expert warnings against them, and that Biden's press secretary says have left him frustrated and exasperated. Joining our conversation, Ashley Parker, Washington Post White House Bureau Chief and an MSNBC political analyst, and Dr. Lippy Roy, Medical Director of the COVID Isolation and Quarantine Sites for Housing Works in New York City. Great to see you both. Dr. Roy, is our halted progress a sign that we could be on the heels of a fourth surge?
So, I mean, great to be with you, Alicia. The good news is that cases and hospitalizations and deaths are going down. But unfortunately, the bad news is that they plateaued. And it's not like they plateaued at the level of zero. They're plateauing at about 65,000 new cases per day. So we are still in the midst of a pandemic. We have these new variants, contagious variants from around the globe that are now circulating all over the United States. So now is most certainly not the time to be easing evidence-based, life-saving mitigation measures. You can't just put the cart before the horse. It's like frosting a cake while it's still a raw batter. It's not the right thing to do. It's going to lead to more cases, infections, hospitalizations, deaths. And as you know, Lisa, it's going to be a burden on me and my colleagues in hospitals. It's going to lead to more depression, burnout, and just adverse consequences to the entire healthcare system, Alicia.
Well, Dr. Roy, stay on that point, because I think you can hear this news and say, well, that's what's happening in Texas. That's what's happening in Mississippi. That's what's happening in Alabama. What does it mean for the rest of the country if you have states that begin lifting their mandates before it is time?
It's one thing if we were dealing with a non-communicable disease, say lung cancer, say heart disease, heart failure, lupus. These are not the types of diseases that spread person to person. Unfortunately, we're dealing with an infectious disease and one that's caused by a virus, SARS-CoV-2, for which we have no effective treatment and certainly no cure. This virus is tricky. It knows how to survive, mutate, and thrive. And as we already have seen, this virus virus does not respect borders. No virus or pathogen, infectious pathogen, does. So what it means is that unless you lock down a certain state or a region, people are going to be moving around. They're going to be spreading the virus. It's going to mean bad things, not only for the United States, but also the entire world. We live in a world with other people.
Ashley Parker, we were just talking about the big lie as a litmus test for Trumpism. Today, you have Alabama's Republican governor announcing that she's going to end her state's mask mandate on April 9th again, no matter what happens. Is this the new litmus test on Trumpism, how defiant state leaders want to be in the face of an actual national plan?
Well, one interesting thing is that you'll recall it came out just recently that President Trump and the First Lady got a coronavirus vaccine very quietly before they left the White House. And again, that's not masks. But when you talk about litmus tests and misinformation, there is a portion of the country right now. We don't have enough vaccines for everyone who wants them. At a certain point, experts predict we will have the opposite problem in a couple of months. There are more vaccines than people who are willing to take them, and the country will have to combat vaccine hesitancy. And you see something like President Trump getting that vaccine, but doing so quietly. There's been a lot of criticism, including from Dr. Fauci, of someone like Trump, who does command tremendous influence, power, and respect in his base among Republicans, among many conspiracy theory-minded members of the public, who could have come out and helped on that vaccine front. So I think that's another way of looking at and answering your question.
Dr. Roy, I want to take a listen to that sound that Ashley just referenced, Dr. Fauci talking about what would have happened if the former president had decided to get that vaccine in public. Take a listen.
That would have been an extraordinarily good opportunity to get a signal to the people who would clearly have listened to him the way they listened to him in many other ways. He has a great deal of influence. It was just, unfortunately, a lost opportunity, because he could have gotten a lot of people who are hesitant about getting vaccinated. I'm sorry he didn't do that.
Dr. Wright, this all bears out, too, in the polling that we're seeing about vaccine hesitancy. You have this poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's from mid-February. And you look at the numbers who are already vaccinated, Democrats versus Republicans, 75% of Democrats already vaccinated will get it ASAP, only 41% of Republicans. 38% of Republicans say they will definitely not get it, or they will only get it if required. I mean, what does that tell you about what the Biden administration is up against?
So first of all, God bless Dr. Fauci and his eloquent, tactful wording. I'm going to be a lot more blunt. That was just poor leadership. I mean, for former President Trump to get vaccinated, that's great. But if he had just done that publicly, I mean, as Dr. Fauci pointed out, he has tremendous influence. Heck, if he had ever just posted one tweet saying to his 80 million followers saying, hey, get the vaccine, hey, wear a mask, it would have saved thousands of lives, Alicia. But yeah, I'm actually very optimistic, despite the kind of plateauing of the curve. The Biden administration is clearly following the directives of evidence-based, scientifically trained experts. They're recruiting the right people, the right teams, activating the DPA. They're doing all the right things. They've already vaccinated. They're at a pace of 2 million people getting vaccinated per day, which exceeds that is 1.5 million per day pace. All of that's really promising. However, all people need to get vaccinated. But right now, Black and brown communities are getting vaccinated at lower rates. Yep. And remember, this is a pandemic. People all over the world need to be vaccinated. It's no use just vaccinating one country.
Dr. Roy, I appreciate when you are blunt. Ashley Parker, thank you both for spending some time with us. Up next, there are growing calls for an investigation into how vaccines are being given out in the state of Florida after a report about wealthy, largely white communities jumping the line, with those same people then donating to the governor's political war chest. The reporter on that story next. Back on January 22nd, when less than 3 million people were fully vaccinated nationwide, the management of a small gated community in South Florida reportedly made an astounding announcement. They said that they had vaccinated nearly all of their seniors. According to the Miami Herald, 1,200 residents of the Ocean Reef Club got vaccinated in mid-January. The wealthy enclave is home to several top GOP donors. 17 people gave the state's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, contributions of $5,000 each. One resident, a former Republican governor himself, wrote a $250,000 check just last month. A spokesperson for DeSantis told the Miami Herald that the governor had no role in getting vaccines to the community. Joining us now, one of the reporters who broke that story, Mary Ellen Kloss, Tallahassee bureau chief for the Miami Herald, and Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large at The Bulwark, as well as an MSNBC contributor. Mary Ellen, what questions does DeSantis's control of the vaccine initiative raise for you?
Well, from the very start, we have not had a very clear or transparent process for how the vaccine's been rolling out in Florida. The governor did something more than ahead of other states, and that is he said that he was going to put a priority on people who are over 65. And that really made a lot of sense in a state with so many seniors. But in the process, we never got a clear idea as to which communities were being selected and why. And starting in January, there were a lot of the very wealthy communities. We started to notice the zip codes in these places around the state. Those people were getting vaccines far and away ahead of others. We just managed to get a copy of this internal email, and it indicated that in January, at a time when other parts of the state were struggling to get vaccine, this community had a pretty easy supply.
Charlie,
and so the questions that have emerged are simply, how did this happen? What was the plan?
I'm going to continue to watch for your reporting on those questions. Charlie, DeSantis' stock on the rise inside of the GOP, especially as they look for a leader in a post-Trump world? You saw the CPAC straw poll where he came in second, though I wonder about the fact the CPAC was based in Florida, if that skewed those numbers at all. I mean, what does this tell you, right, about his appeal within the party?
No, his stock is rising. In fact, out of the CPAC convention over the weekend, you had two rising stars, Ron DeSantis and Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota. And both of them are riding on their very Trumpy approach to the coronavirus. One of the things that DeSantis has going for him in the modern Republican Party is that he shares or appears to share one of Donald Trump's superpowers, which is complete shamelessness. His aggressive defense, his refusal to back down, his aggressiveness with the media, and his just refusal to acknowledge his critics. So stories like this, I think, are going to reflect the increased scrutiny that the governors really, frankly, ought to receive for their handling of all of this. And right now, the best thing that Ron DeSantis has going for himself, of course, are the problems of Andrew Cuomo. Because trust me, if you bring up this story to any Republican or anyone in the MAGAverse, the first thing they will say is, well, what about what's going on in New York? Well, you can be critical of both states' handlings of this. And I think that they deserve the kind of scrutiny that we're getting. Because, look, you know, something like what happened with the vaccine, that does not happen by accident. I just got vaccinated on Monday, and I know exactly how difficult it is to navigate this system. And so something like this, I think, is going to highlight one of the major problems, the inequities in the distribution of the vaccine. And I hope they continue to shine the spotlight on Ron DeSantis, although don't expect him to back down and continue to point his fingers at other governors like Andrew Cuomo.
Mary Ellen, Charlie headed right where I was going, which is, in as much as there is one conversation to be had about the elements of this that involve donors and political giving, there's also the piece of this which is watching wealthy, largely white communities getting vaccinated while vaccination remains behind in communities of color. Let's take a look at this. I mean, you have African Americans making up 7% of vaccinations in the state when they're 16% of the total population. Latinos make up 17% of vaccinations, even though they're 27% of total population. What does that underscore about the inequities that you're seeing out of Florida when it comes to COVID response?
Well, I don't think those numbers are actually too much of a surprise to many of the public health officials that we've spoken to. They knew that there needed to be an extra effort to try and reach out to these Hispanic and Black communities around the state. And the governor has made some strides in trying to get churches involved and bring the vaccine into those communities. But what his messaging didn't seem to look like that was his priority. He arrived at the villages several times to give, and that is this very conservative, retirement community in the center of Florida. And that's where he gave his first preference. When he was asked about why we're putting a focus on these white communities, his answer was, well, everybody needs to get it. It doesn't really matter whether you're wealthy or not. Everyone needs to get it eventually.
Mary Ellen Klass, Charlie Sykes, thank you both so much. Up next, Jacob Sobroff visiting a growing refugee camp in Tijuana, Mexico this week. And today talked exclusively with the nation's new Homeland Security Secretary about the situation at the border. We'll bring you some of that interview next.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Among the many challenges that President Biden has inherited from the Trump administration, one of the biggest and most critical has been the situation happening on the southern border. New documents obtained by NBC News show the U.S. Customs and Border Protection has a growing backlog of unaccompanied migrant children in its custody, with hundreds being held longer than the legal limit of 72 hours. On top of that, nearly 100 of those children held past the limit are under the age of 13. President Biden's new DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas spoke exclusively this morning with NBC's Jacob Sobroff about the growing crisis.
NBC News has obtained data that shows as of Tuesday, CBP had 1,763 unaccompanied kids in its custody. 625 of them were there longer than the legal 72-hour limit to be transferred out to HHS. That same day, my understanding is you briefed the President of the United States at the White House about the fact DHS projects 117,000 unaccompanied children. 117,000 could cross the border this year. That would be a record. Is that number accurate, first of all? And how do you plan on processing treating those children who come to the United States humanely?
What we are doing is building the capacity to address the needs of those children, and we are guided by some core principles. Number one, we act in the best interest of the children, and we act in the best interest of the American people. And thirdly, we adhere to our values and principles as a country. And so, in fact, the numbers are significant, the challenge is significant, and our plans are well underway as we build the capacity to address the needs of the children, and we are rebuilding from scratch.
Joining us now, NBC News correspondent Jacob Sobroff, live at the southern border, and Maria Teresa Kumar, president and CEO of Voto Latino, an MSNBC contributor. Jacob, I am very much looking forward to watching this interview in its entirety. Let's talk, though, about the clip that we just listened to. Children being kept at facilities that are not equipped for this. Migrant children supposed to be transferred into custody within 72 hours. What's the holdup? Why is this taking so long?
A capacity, Alicia, and you heard Secretary Mayorkas say that very plainly. You know, he said we need to build the capacity, and the reason there were 625 children in the custody of the Border Patrol in stations along like places just like where I am right now in Otay Mesa for longer than 72 hours, the legal limit, is because there is not room for them in Health and Human Services shelters where they are cared for by child welfare professionals. That's why we heard that HHS was opening that influx facility in Carrizo Springs, Texas. It's why the Border Patrol is standing up processing centers in places like Donna, Texas. They're talking about opening facilities in Del Rio and elsewhere. And when you hear the secretary say building capacity, that's exactly what he means. They need the space to get children, number one, out of the Border Patrol stations, which are essentially jails. You remember in 2019 when kids were laying on concrete floors under those Mylar blankets, jammed together, some sleeping even outside in those kind of cage-like facilities. They want to avoid that at all costs. And where it's a big departure, frankly, from the Trump administration, there are many departures, but a big one is using the language, the best interests of the child. That's how child welfare professionals often refer to caring for children. It's not how law enforcement, especially the Border Patrol, has historically referred to caring for children, and they're signaling a departure. The policy and the practice has not quite caught up yet to the realities on the ground.
Jacob, did you get a sense of timeline from the secretary?
I think it's a great point. He basically said they're going to do it as needed, roll out capacity as needed. I'll tell you what, right now, they need capacity. The idea that there are 625, were as of Tuesday, kids over the legal limit in Border Patrol stations, it means they need that capacity right now. I wouldn't be surprised if we heard from Homeland Security or HHS the addition of those types of facilities in the not-too-distant future.
Maria Teresa, children at the southern border had to manage their arrivals safely, humanely. It's one piece of the immigration landscape. At the same time, there is appetite to begin contending with the way the system is broken inside of the country. There's a big comprehensive piece of legislation. We learned today Dems don't believe they have the votes to bring it to the floor just yet. I don't know that any of the three of us find that surprising. But does that create then more momentum behind these standalone efforts on DREAM and Promise and essential workers?
I think that's exactly right, Alicia. What we are seeing is that not only is there momentum, but there is a great desire among the immigrant rights movements, along with the administration, along with a lot of the members of Congress, to start putting some points on the board, to start providing alleviation for these immigrant families who have felt such distress under the Trump administration for 4 years, and saying we are going to not only provide relief, but for the Biden administration needs to be able to demonstrate that he's delivering on his campaign promises. So while the piece of legislation that was sent over from the White House down to the House is incredibly comprehensive, there's also an understanding that it's going to be broken up more than likely. And we want to make sure that we're providing as much relief as to the families that are living within our border as much as possible. But even when we're talking about the reunification proposal from the task force that Mayorkas has put together, it is incredibly comprehensive. It's talking about wraparound services, Alicia, everything from reuniting families, giving them the option to reunify here or back at home, but also providing them with support services such as mental health, recognizing that the trauma that many of these families and these children have suffered under the Trump administration is not going to be erased. So again, I do think that what Jacob is saying is absolutely true. It's like they're centering this around the most vulnerable. How do they do it well? And at the same time, how do they put people, young people, children, back into the system in places that are secure and vetted? And that is one of the top priorities as well from the administration, from what I understand.
Well, nobody is going anywhere. We're going to bring you a bit more from Jacob's interview and ask if anyone from the Trump administration could be held criminally accountable.
President Biden tweeted during the campaign, children should be released from ICE detention with their parents immediately. That would seem that he would like to end family detention. That's not the case, or you can't commit to that at this point?
Jacob, a detention facility is not where a family belongs.
We're back with Jacob Soboroff and Maria Teresa Kumar. Jacob, what did you make of his answer there on detaining families?
I thought it was an incredibly important statement by Secretary Mayorkas. It wasn't a commitment to closing the three family detention centers, what some advocates literally call baby jails. But it would be a significant departure if there were no longer families detained together by the Biden administration. That would be a departure not only from the Trump administration, which refused to release many families detained together, but also from the Obama administration, which mm-hmm. candidly opened these facilities in the first place.
Maria Teresa, there is great enthusiasm. There's great urgency on the part of advocates to get that done. How do they continue to hold the administration accountable?
I think you're going to see a two-part strategy. One is very much at the table. I think that what makes these promises so starkly different from even the Obama administration is that the people inside the White House advising the policy, they themselves were advocates. They were themselves were the ones that were trying to get pull people to the fire, and now they're on the inside. And so it's very much how do you bring folks together behind closed doors, providing people time. You know, we have to recognize that the Biden administration has now inherited a deeply broken system and has been at the helm for less than 40 days. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is giving them time to make sure that, again, they're showing results, that they're keeping their promises. But in the event that they don't, making sure that there's visibility. No one knows how to mobilize, I think, in this space better than the dreamers, the raices, folks that go down the line that, again, are really paying attention by saying, let's give the administration some time to breathe and put some stuff back together again, because it's absolutely broken, Alicia.
Jacob, did you get a sense from the secretary of this administration's appetite for holding the last administration accountable?
You know, it was hard, quite frankly. He didn't rule it out, particularly around the family separation policy. I asked him, because the attorney general is going to be a member, according to the executive order, once he's confirmed, of the task force to reunite the separated families, whether or not a potential criminal investigation would be part of the attorney general's duties. And he said that, essentially, paraphrasing here, that everything is still on the table. He could have said no. He could have said it's just about reuniting the families. But that's not what Secretary Mayorkas told me today.
All right, Jacob Soboroff, I cannot wait to watch this entire interview. Maria Teresa Kumar, thank you both for spending some time with us. That's it for me this hour. The next hour of Deadline White House with Dr. Jason Johnson starts right after this quick break.
You know, it's concerning among colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans. I have a lot of respect for the Capitol Police and National Guard who are guarding the building. It's just very, very sad. And I think Americans should reflect on that. The actual business of the people in the House of Representatives today was grounded to a halt. Members of Congress aren't able to come to where to do their jobs for democracy. This is a big deal and a really sad day in American democracy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Johnson in for Nicole Wallace. It's 5 o'clock in Washington, where the U.S. Capitol and the rest of the city are on high alert. The House canceled its session today following the threat of another attack on the building almost exactly 2 months after the insurrection. A joint bulletin issued by the FBI and the DHS warned that some domestic groups had, quote, discussed plans to take control of the U.S. Capitol and remove Democratic lawmakers on or about today, March 4th. Nice for them to give us a heads up. And now a very visible, heightened security and military presence in Washington. 5,000 National Guard troops remain stationed to protect the Capitol, and there are barricades securing the building. And the threat is not going away anytime soon. Today, the Capitol Police requested the National Guard continue to provide security for another 2 months. But let's remember what got us to this point, what got us to needing barbed wire surrounding the People's House. It was the complicity of Republicans in the big lie. The lie that Joe Biden's victory was the result of widespread voter fraud and black and brown people voting at high rates. A lie that was debunked by dozens of lawsuits, local elected officials, Republicans and Democrats, and security experts. In refusing to condemn the big lie, Republicans are perpetuating it. What we've witnessed from members of the GOP since Donald Trump's loss has not been a show of courage or reassessment of their role in assaulting our democracy. Instead, it's been a show of defiance against truth, justice, the American way, common sense, responsible leadership. Like this weekend at CPAC, where several elected Republicans continued to spew falsehoods about a stolen election. Like Senator Ron Johnson pushing the already debunked conspiracy theory that Antifa or fake Trump supporters were behind the Capitol riot at a Senate hearing devoted to understanding what actually occurred on that day. And like former Vice President Mike Pence, who finally came out of hiding, broke his silence after the insurrection, and chose to call out, quote, voting irregularities and numerous instances of officials setting aside state election law. Claims discredited by Trump's own appointed director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, who held his position at the time these so-called voting irregularities were taking place. Here's Wray when asked about security of our election in a Senate hearing earlier this week.
Do you agree with Attorney General Barr's statement that there is absolutely no evidence of voter fraud that could have changed the outcome of the 2020 presidential election?
I agree with Attorney General Barr.
And to be crystal clear on this, as FBI director, who is this, these would be federal crimes, you're aware of no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, correct?
We are not aware of any widespread evidence of voter fraud, much less that would have affected the outcome in the presidential election.
It's a nothing burger, it's a nothing falafel, it's a nothing wrap. The big lie is nonsense. The continued fallout of the big lie is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large at the 19th, is here. Also with us, Sam Stein, political White House editor, and Elizabeth Newman, former Assistant Secretary for Threat Prevention and Security Policy at the Department of Homeland Security, and now the co-director of the Republican Accountability Project. Thank you all so much for being here. We're going to start, Sam. I want you to hear this sound from Bennett earlier today talking about what's actually been going on and what Republicans are doing to not help us get past this big lie.
I wish Ron Johnson would use his time to explain to the Trump voters that the election wasn't stolen and that millions of people, you know, didn't vote for Donald Trump instead of Joe Biden. That'd be a good use of 10 hours of Ron Johnson's time. But instead, we're in a lockdown capital and he's forcing the staff under those conditions to sit there and read a bill, something he never did, by the way, when he was voting for tax cuts for rich people.
Sam, when you hear that sound and you hear Senator Michael Bennett say, look, my colleagues are nuts. What is happening in the Senate right now? How are Democrats looking at their Republican colleagues who are still 2 and 3 months after the fact perpetuating a lie that doesn't just impact what's happening on the ground, but is now endangering everyone's safety?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's important to understand that Michael Bennett is not your typical flamethrower. I mean, I'd be very shocked to know how many times speeches of his are featured on cable news, because he's just not normally this incendiary or pointed in his criticism of colleagues. And it gets to the frustration that a lot of Democrats on the Hill do feel right now, that Republicans are perpetuating this myth, this falsehood, this lie, that the election was stolen. Every nonpartisan indicator, every person who's looked into it has said that's not the case. And I do think underlying this all is a fear among Democrats nationally, and I should stress locally, that one of the reasons that this notion that the election was stolen is continuously perpetuated by Republicans is that they want to use it as a predicate of sorts to restrict voting laws and voting rights going forward. We're already seeing efforts on the local level to do so, citing this non-truthful accusation that we don't have a valid vote. That's just not the case, but it is being used as a predicate. And so I think Democrats, in addition to knowing the sort of acute physical harm that this lie caused, are looking forward and saying, my God, are they going to turn around and use this to further restrict voting access?
Along those same lines, Elizabeth, I have to ask you this. Now, you are part of the Republican Accountability Project. You're not a psychiatrist, right? Just want to make sure.
I am not.
Okay, because I was initially going to ask you if Mike Pence is suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. You know, after finally coming out and speaking publicly, the first thing he does is put this op-ed in the Daily Signal where he perpetuates the same big lie that put his life at risk. When you're working with Republicans and having conversations, what did they think about this op-ed, and how ridiculous is it that Mike Pence is saying on the one hand the election was fraudulent, but on the other hand wouldn't supposedly go along with this fraud when he was actually in a position to do something about it?
So I'm not a psychiatrist, but I do study the Bible a lot. And there's this great passage that talks about being turned over to your sin and your conscience being seared. And I think that describes Mike Pence at this point, where he has spent so much time covering up for Donald Trump. And, look, when he was on the inside, he would push back and he lost a lot. But every once in a while, he would win. And so I'm not going to say there was no attempt at doing good. I'm sure he thought he was doing the right thing, but he became complicit in all of the president's lies and all of the president's malfeasance, and culminating in that big lie. And if your life getting threatened doesn't break you out of it, I don't know that anything will. And I think what's particularly dangerous about his line of arguments, and you're starting to see other Republicans pick up on it, is they're kind of moving away from the election was stolen and they're whitewashing it. They're just talking about, we just need to make sure that there's no fraud in elections. And of course, it's a dog whistle. The base understands that what they're talking about is fixing what they believe was a stolen election. But it really is about suppressing the vote, restricting voting access so that they can maintain power. And that's really dangerous. That's a dangerous place for the Republican Party to be against voting access. But sadly, that's where we are. And I don't think he's ever going to snap out of it.
Yeah, to paraphrase another passage from the good book, it would be easier for a camel to get to the eye of the needle than it would be for Mike Pence to break away from Donald Trump. Aaron, when we hear about this, I have to ask you, with one political party committed to something that is just patently not true, but the country still facing a huge, terrible pandemic, is there much of a chance here that actual legislation can be done? I mean, is it just the Democrats have to decide that Republicans, hey, they just want to believe this lie, they want to believe in Santa Claus, and we can move forward? Or do you think that this big lie that they're perpetuating is going to have serious consequences on legislation that the country needs?
Well, gee, Jason, I knew you were a doctor, but I didn't know you were a pastor, too. Look at you quoting scripture.
Pass the plate.
You know, exactly. So I think that that is the question. You saw the House passing H.R. 1. We're headed into Bloody Sunday, you know, which was the catalyst for the Voting Rights Act. Democrats are certainly framing this as kind of a 21st century version of the Voting Rights Act. And I think that we need to be clear that efforts to that we're seeing in state legislatures, like in my home state of Georgia, and really across the country, to combat the false threat of voter fraud is what 21st century voter suppression looks like. And so, you know, to your point, just in the opening, that former Vice President Pence would resurface, you know, not to thank Capitol Police or to urge Americans to get the vaccine, but to talk about, you know, the looming threat of voter fraud and the Democrats, you know, seeking to nationalize elections. The thing about the big lie, again, I'm from Georgia. You've spent some time in Georgia. The big lie is nothing new in this country, but the big lie was nationalized under former President Trump. And, you know, he talks about, you know, Democrats seeking to nationalize elections. Republicans are seeking to nationalize voter suppression with these onerous laws that are not really addressing any election fraud, which you know, our own government has said is virtually non-existent. You had Christopher Wray doing that yet again just this week in his testimony. And so, you know, the big lie, apparently it is going to continue to be repeated. Mike Pence has now become the latest Republican to repeat the big lie. And just as the big lie is being repeated, I think it is on responsible Americans and people who are concerned about the future of our democracy to continue to repeat the truth that there was no widespread voter fraud in the last election, that in fact, the last election was the safest in our country's history, according to our own federal government, and that this is a solution that continues to be in search of a problem.
You know, speaking of big little lies, I want you to listen to this sound, Aaron. We'll stick with you for a minute. This is from the head of the Capitol Hill Police. I want you to listen to this sound about what the impact of these lies have been and how it's changed how people are trying to get their jobs done in Congress.
In the first 2 months of 2021, there has been over a 93% increase in the threats to members compared to the same period last year. And from 2017 to 2020, there has been over a 118% increase in the total threats and directions of interest with overwhelmingly majority of those suspects residing outside of Washington, D.C.
Aaron, I know you work at the 19th. You talk about the intersection of race and gender. It sounds to me like what the chief is talking about is a hostile workplace. I mean, is that what you're hearing based on her assessment on the threats to the lawmakers right now?
Absolutely. And you saw Speaker Pelosi certainly taking this threat seriously, getting those votes done last night, and then, frankly, getting the hell out of Dodge today because, of this threat of potential violence. And, you know, people like Chief Pittman, people like General Walker, who testified yesterday in that Senate hearing. I mean, these are folks who saw the threat of white supremacy as very real, which, again, FBI Director Wray reiterated is the greatest threat to our country domestically in terms of domestic terrorism, and is also a threat that is still very much with us. Look, we're still, like you said, less than 2 months out from that violent insurrection, which again was about negating the votes of Black and Brown people as illegal in this country, right? And so, that was a threat that was present before January 6th. And that is a threat that, because of the persistence of the big lie, continues to be with us today.
Speaking of Christopher Wray, Sam, I want you to listen to this sound. Look, I think we're hearing the same thing over and over again from these experts. But I think the terminology that he uses here is something I really want your comments on the other side.
January 6th was not an isolated event. The problem of domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country for a long time now, and it's not going away anytime soon. At the FBI, we've been sounding the alarm on it for a number of years now. In fact, we viewed it as such a critical threat that back in June of 2019, under my leadership, we elevated racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism to our highest threat priority, on the same level with ISIS and homegrown violent extremists, where it remains to this day.
Sam, it sounds to me like he's basically saying we've got homegrown terrorism, the levels of which we've probably never seen in this country. What were your thoughts?
You know, my thoughts when I heard that actually immediately went back to the early Obama years. Back then, the Department of Homeland Security sort of famously put out a report on right-wing extremism. And there was a huge political pushback among Republicans over that report, so much so that the person involved with it resigned and they retracted the document. And ever since then, we've had this kind of uncomfortable political posture towards addressing this threat. We've had this through the Obama years and also, frankly, through the Trump years, despite what FBI Director Wray said there. Over the past 4 years in the Trump years, there was always this tug and pull over whether or not you could talk about this openly. And if you did, right, would you be perceived of having a bias? Should you have to address groups like Antifa in the same context? And we've never really been able to grapple with the proportionality of the threat. I mean, the threat obviously exists, the proportionality that we need to grapple with. And I still think we're having trouble grappling with it. And in addition to that, we're having trouble grappling with the roots of it, right? I mean, a lot of this is fed by online news and information systems that are just filtered with or overflowing with bad information.
And in addition, Sam, I mean, a lot of this honestly is just being filtered by one party. Very quickly, Elizabeth, I want to get to your thoughts on this. You know, everybody's determined that a lot of this came from Donald Trump. I want you to listen to this sound, Elizabeth, from Mitch McConnell and Brian Kemp talking about the future of the Republican Party with Donald Trump in 2024.
If the president was the party's nominee, would you support him?
The nominee of the party? Absolutely.
Donald Trump is the 24 nominee for Republicans. Would you support him?
Absolutely. I'm going to support the nominee.
I mean, Elizabeth, look, Donald Trump has gone after Brian Kemp. He's gone after Mitch McConnell. Can we do anything about this rising domestic terror level if every single member, sitting member of the Republican Party is still committed to the head of the terrorist organization?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would critique with your assertion is that the problem with violent white supremacy has been around, sadly, for decades. He just tapped into it, and he did embolden it. But you're right. Like, if as long as they keep empowering him, even though they are probably not doing it, at least not wittingly for racist means, but because of power, they are still feeding into that system that will continue continue to promote violent extremism as a legitimate way to express your viewpoint on when you've lost an election. We really, really have got to hold these Republicans accountable, and we need to make sure that we get strong, whether I don't care if they're Democrats or independents or moderate Republicans, but we've got to get some of these Republicans without character out of office.
Exactly. Sam Stein and Elizabeth Newman, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. Aaron Haynes is sticking around. When we return, as we've been discussing, Republicans are weaponizing the big lie to restrict and suppress voting around the country. Now, Democrats are pushing back, but they're facing an uphill battle. That's next. Plus, 30 years after Rodney King was beaten on camera by Los Angeles police, the House of Representatives passed a police reform bill named after another victim of police brutality, George Floyd. We'll discuss why the struggle for justice is still ongoing decades later. And the challenge of getting Americans, all Americans of all colors, vaccinated against the coronavirus. We'll get a live report from one of FEMA's massive vaccination centers. Deadline White House continues after a quick break, so don't go anywhere.
This legislation is there to protect the right to vote, to remove obstacles of participation. H.R. 1, for the people. For the people, the first 300 pages were written by John Lewis to remove voter suppression tactics from our political system. What's exciting about it is that it restores confidence that people have that their vote and their voice is as important as anyone's.
Speaker Pelosi's mask game is always on point. That was Speaker Pelosi this morning, reminding us of the role of the late John Lewis in the landmark voting rights expansion bill passed in the House last night. The bill, passed mostly along party lines, would be the most significant improvement in voting protections since the 60s, enacting new requirements, weakening state voter ID laws, mandating automatic voter registration, and expanding early voting, among other protections. But the legislation passed as Republicans around the country try to restrict ballot access and peddle the big lie of election fraud. So it seems doomed in the Senate, where a 60-vote filibuster seems impossible for Democrats to overcome. Joining our conversation is Fernand Amandi, Democratic pollster and MSNBC political analyst. Welcome to the family. And the 19th Aaron Haynes is back with us. Fernand, I'm going to start with you because I think this is important. When you see this kind of legislation being passed, you're a pollster. How important is election reform to just regular voters? Is it something on their top 10 list? Are they out there complaining about it? Or is this something driven primarily by the politicians?
Excellent question. I'm not so sure, Jason, the voters give it the degree of priority that maybe they do more the bread and butter daily issues that they're facing. But from the perspective of the country, and more importantly, the Democratic Party, look, there are two priorities that the Biden administration and the congressional majority has to get done. The first priority is crystal clear. It's to save American lives and the American economy from the threat of the pandemic. And the good news is everything seems to be very much on course there, particularly with the announcement recently that we're going to have full vaccination by the end of May, 2 months ahead of schedule. The second most important priority, however, is saving American democracy from the clutches of the Republican Party, because the biggest political story, in my judgment, of the last two centuries has been the fact that today's Republican Party has, in essence, Jason, abandoned American democracy, the central tenet of what the Constitution is about. So unless the Democrats actually get this across the finish line, they are not only jeopardizing their ability to govern, they're jeopardizing the very essence of what this country is all about.
Aaron, we're going to do sort of a legislative unboxing video here, right? We're just going to open this whole thing up. What's actually in this For the People bill? The Republicans are saying it's got all this sort of extra nonsense in it. The Democrats are saying it addresses these issues of importance. What's actually in the bill? Why is it important?
Well, I want to back up for just a second, if I can, Jason, because I mean, I'm no Fernand, I'm not a pollster, but I certainly talked to so many voters in the 2020 cycle for whom, one, racism was on the ballot, and for whom voter suppression was absolutely a driving issue to the ballot box last year. Look, I mean, they voted to overcome voter suppression even in the midst of a pandemic. And, you know, what we're seeing, the backlash in these Republican state legislatures is in direct response to that expanded electorate participating in ways that in many states were reserved only, you know, for Republican and white voters, you know, historically speaking. But, you know, you used to have federal redress. And in fact, the Supreme Court in Shelby versus Holder kicked it to Congress, right, to address and update the Voting Rights Act. And so that is what H.R. 1, according to Democrats, purports to do, you know, expanding access to the ballot, making it easier for voters to register, you know, wanting to, you know, talking about same day registration in some cases. I mean, there are many things that are talking about the types of things that would expand the electorate as opposed to the types of things that are on the march right now in state legislatures, like restricting early voting, limiting precincts, certainly less funding, you know, for elections at the state level. You know, the HR 1 is really aimed at combating a lot of those things, and really with time being of the essence, because state legislatures are seeking to pass bills that would do that even as we speak.
So, Fernand, it appears as though you have spoken into the mind of Senator Dick Durbin. He basically said the same thing. I mean, he said, look, as far as legislation goes, this is the most important thing, one of the most important things that the Democrats could be doing right now. But as we all know, with a nominal degree of understanding of civics, this is going to require 60 votes in the Senate. And as of right now, that's not possible with the filibuster. I want to jump past these questions of, OK, how does the government work, et cetera, et cetera. What should this administration be doing right now to push Joe Manchin and Sinema to a lesser degree so that they will actually allow this kind of legislation to pass? Because I don't think the technicalities matter as much as there's not enough pressure being put on these guys to actually get this legislation through.
Look, I could be crazy here, and I don't mean to spoil the party for or let the secret out for Sinema and Manchin. But look, I think if it comes down to a vote, they're going to be there, right? They're going to be there on most of these issues. But you can't take the politics out of the politics. Certainly in the case of Joe Manchin, who's trying to do whatever he can to stay as the only statewide elected Democrat in West Virginia, which we know is a hard state. Sinema is doing similar political gamesmanship in Arizona. But fundamentally, I think you hit it on the head, Jason. What does this come down to? It comes down to the elimination of the filibuster, which in one of these historical accidents or ironies really is a racist tool to prevent civil rights legislation from having gone forward over the centuries. So I think the predicate here is to establish that Republican obstructionism to the idea of making democracy stronger, increasing access to the democracy, is the roadblock. And if they can make that case on this and maybe a host of other issues, I really believe in my bones, and I think the Biden White House does as well, that those two votes that are on the periphery in Manchin and Sinema will be there, and that will allow Vice President Harris to do her thing, which the voters of Georgia made happen, which is to cast that tie-breaking vote.
Fernand, you are way more optimistic about these two than I am. Fernand Armandi, thank you so much. Erin is staying with us. She's not going anywhere. When we return, the House of Representatives passing the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, 30 years to the day after the Rodney King beating, underscores just how far we still have to go on the issue of racial justice in this country. We'll be joined by the Reverend Al Sharpton after a quick break.
Hundreds of angry demonstrators were waiting for embattled LAPD Chief Daryl Gates as he appeared at the Los Angeles Police Commission's investigation of the Rodney King beating. Black leaders continue to demand Gates' resignation. He continues to resist.
Chief Gates' entire tenure as the city's top law enforcement official has been marked by insensitivity at best and straight-out hostility at worst.
The King case was even discussed in Congress.
What happened to Rodney King is a blot on Los Angeles and on this nation. We must see that it never happens again.
The brutal beating of Rodney King, all caught on camera thanks to an amateur photographer, made the conversation around police brutality mainstream. Led to a generation of leaders and activists who hoped that finally white Americans would wake up to the crisis of police brutality. I know when I saw it at the time, many black people were thinking, oh, they can't ignore this one. But here we are 30 years later. It's worth thinking about Rodney King right now, because on the 30th anniversary of the night that the Los Angeles Police Department nearly beat King to death, the House passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, a series of criminal justice reforms named after a man who died after a white police officer knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. The incident, filmed by another bystander, was so shocking that it led to massive nationwide protests. That bill now meets the cold, hard reality of the Senate, where, thanks to the filibuster, it'll need 10 Republican votes to pass. Joining us now, I cannot think of a better person to talk to than the Reverend Al Sharpton, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. And Aaron Haynes is also back with us. Rev, I want to say this. I'm so happy that I get a chance to talk to you about this today. Look, you were in the thick of things, right? I was barely in training wheels. I was watching you on television 30 years ago fighting for these issues. Here we are 30 years later. The George Floyd Policing Act has passed the House. I just want to hand you the microphone. Have we made that much progress, or do you think we're basically just spinning our wheels?
I think, Jason, that when I think about we had the marches and I was involved in, I was into my 30s for Rodney King, and ultimately was friends with Rodney till he died. I spoke at his funeral. And then I led marches last year on George Floyd and preached both of his funeral. But then I think about the Scottsboro case happened decades before we got the 64 Civil Rights Act. Movements don't happen overnight to make change. And if they didn't give up in the 40s and then the 50s and then get legislation to the 60s and then they tried to reverse them, then I think that maybe we had to fight decades and finally crack in policing. But let us not pop the champagne yet, because we got a House vote last night. Now it goes to the Senate. And what the Senate is going to do with this bill, whether they are going to try and water it down, dilute it, we've been, the leaders of national civil rights groups have been talking to Senator Schumer and Senator Cory Booker and others. And we are facing the same thing in a generation ahead of me, a couple of generations ahead of Aaron. And Aaron was on training wheels when you were already driving your Mercedes. But when we go forward, we're going to face what they did in 64, 65. They're going to try to dilute. The bill they passed in 64 was not all they wanted, but it was all they could get. We got to make sure that they don't water this bill down. That's the challenge we face as we work with Congresswoman Beattie and others in the Congressional Black Caucus. But the good news is we never had a bill on policing to this degree pass the House. And the fact that we've gotten this far is because we have 50 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and because every Democratic candidate did say during the primaries that they would do this. And it appears that Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are keeping their word. The question is now the Senate and putting pressure on the senators.
So, Aaron, it always seems to go back to this. We hit the Senate and then it's literally a brick wall. What strategically? Look, obviously, you're going to have Republicans who have issues with it, but there are some Republicans in Congress who care a little bit about policing reform. Where do you think Democrats have to go to try and wiggle out a couple other votes or to get some decent compromises so that a variation of this bill could actually get passed?
Well, listen, Tim Scott was certainly somebody who spoke about, policing disparities in Black communities last summer. We still are in the midst of this national reckoning, which is now headed to, what is the policy solution for that? And now that this has landed on the Senate's doorstep, I think that is the question. That's certainly what a lot of Democrats voted for this Democratic majority to try to do. But to your point, yes, Republicans will have to be persuaded. Jason, you and I were in Ferguson, and I wonder if you remember Republicans then being kind of outraged about the civil liberties component of this, right? I mean, we're talking about banning chokeholds and banning no-knock warrants and qualified immunity that would mean that police officers would be subject to the same rules that apply to the rest of us when Americans are harmed or killed. So, I think
this is obviously been a very politically and racially polarized issue, but I think that having a conversation with Republicans who were among the Americans who were outraged by what they saw happen to George Floyd, how that translates into policy in the Senate, is going to be what makes a difference and tells us how many Republicans ultimately in the Senate may vote for this. I think, you know, we saw in the House vote last night, there was a Republican who voted for it by accident. So I don't know how Republicans will vote for it on purpose in the Senate by the time this thing is said and done.
Hey, look, even if we stumble backwards into justice, it's still justice. You know, Rev, one of the things I've noticed, it's interesting that the change in language in the discussion of these issues, right? 30 years ago, it was the Rodney King trial, even though he wasn't the one on trial. We had to fight in public discourse to have it called the Zimmerman trial instead of the Trayvon Martin trial. Well, now we're in the Derek Chauvin trial. This is the man who put his knee and killed George Floyd. As we begin jury selection next week, what needs to be the strategy for activists who are concerned about police violence? We're all going to be riveted to this case, but what are some things that people on the ground are going to be doing to make sure that public attention stays on this and this trial doesn't somehow disappear into all the other tragedies and difficulties we're facing in the country right now?
Well, we have developed strategy, many of the civil rights groups, many of us that were involved with the family, of making sure that we are visible but nonviolent. Because we do not want to have the perception that George Floyd was in any way acting in a way that they had to hold him down and put his knee on the neck. So you cannot go out there and do violence and get in the way of bringing the facts to the jury that this was not about a policeman defending himself. This was about a policeman that for 8 minutes and 46 seconds kept their knee on the neck. So you have to be strategic, but you have to keep this front and center. And you've got to deal with the moral outrage of what would make a man. When I did the eulogy, I'll use this example, Jason, and I asked everybody to stand up wherever they were. People were watching everywhere globally for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. I can't tell you how many emails I got of people telling me they couldn't stand 3 minutes without getting tired. It takes a whole lot of intent and hate to press down 8 minutes. Don't get in the way of the jury feeling what that is. This is not no momentary anger that I lost it. You have to have a lot of venom and intent to press on somebody who's pleading for their life for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. When they choked Eric Garner in New York, 11 times he said, "I can't breathe." We were able to turn that into an Eric Garner law statewide. We got it passed. Now we need to have the nation deal with 8 minutes and 46 seconds to change federal law on the things that Aaron just outlined. It would change policing, and it would not be to hurt police. It would be to protect citizens and good police at the same time.
Aaron Haynes,
and Jason,
thank you
can
for
I just say something here?
Sure, real quick.
Jason, I just have to say something here because Reverend Sharpton's presence here alone just tells us the arc of this thing. I mean, how many funerals Reverend Sharpton has how many eulogies he has done, how many protests he has presided over, how many times he has pushed for justice in these communities, in the dozens, in the hundreds, you know, I would venture. And so, the time for action on this issue, I mean, Reverend Sharpton just embodies this so much. Just listening to him recount all of the times that he has had to make the case for this, and certainly is, I think the court of public opinion is changing. But whether an actual courtroom is going to change, we have yet to know.
Yeah, the time for action is now. Thank you so much, Aaron Haynes. Thank you for spending some time with us today. Reverend Al is sticking around. Thank you both so much. I could talk to you guys for an hour about this. When we return, the Biden administration's latest weapon in the race to vaccinate as many Americans as possible. That's next.
Community vaccine centers, mobile units to go out into poorly serviced areas, people who don't have good access, pharmacies that are going to have a lot of vaccines that people can get to, and getting vaccinators, people who will be able to put the vaccine into people's arms. Those are all challenges. I believe they're going to work very well because the president is very serious about making this a very, very high priority.
Dr. Fauci, today on the Biden administration's ramped up efforts to put vaccine doses into people's arms and making sure everyone has fair access, with still major discrepancies in who is receiving the vaccine. Comes as the U.S. is now averaging about 2 million vaccinations per day for the first time, compared to about 1.3 million just a month ago. To help solve equity challenges, FEMA has set up 440 mass vaccination sites across the country to increase access for minorities and underserved communities, those most at risk of catching and then dying from COVID. One that opened yesterday in downtown Philadelphia demonstrates the size and scope of the administration's efforts, expecting to vaccinate up to 6,000 people per day. Joining us now is Heidi Prisbilla at that FEMA vaccination site at the Philadelphia Convention Center, and the Reverend Al Sharpton is back with us. Heidi, I'll start with you. That is a great outfit. You're fully masked up and ready. What's it like there? I mean, obviously, there are crowds of people. They're all coming in. Do you see a diverse group of people? Do you see mostly white people? What's the crowd and what do the demographics look like there in what appears to be a very chilly Philadelphia?
Well, first of all, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, Jason, but I think I know what you're asking, which is this working? Are we seeing diverse people come in here? And the answer is yes. Now, these types of sites were chosen specifically for that purpose. There are only a few of them, actually, that are this humongous. We're talking about 6,000 people a day at capacity here to bring them in. The CDC, as well as census data they're using to try and determine where to put these sites to try and find socially vulnerable people, Jason. And we actually had an exclusive interview with the acting FEMA director about this and about how they are choosing sites exactly like this. Take a listen.
We've seen a continuing increase in going ahead and reaching the most socially vulnerable populations, the ones most at risk, and seeing our percentages go up. There's different ways that we've been able to do it in different areas, and we're kind of learning as this is a pilot right now on how to build those relationships. What we first did is set them up for a day and moved them. And now we found that if we leave them there for a little longer, we build trust, we build confidence, more people are willing to come in and get vaccinated.
Jason, that is an example of how they're choosing these sites. And it's also about location, location, not just about data, right? It's about putting these sites in places where people who may be underserved can get there. People who are underserved oftentimes don't have wheels, right? So you put this in a place where you've got a lot of access to mass transit, buses, the subway lines, and that's how they're doing this. I've talked to a lot of the individuals here today. They're finding out about it through their churches. They're finding out about it through their community leaders. They have the city council in here getting a tour. But, you know, there's also a lot of younger people here. So there's questions remain about how these appointments are actually getting made. But for right now, a lot of diversity in this crowd.
Speaking of diversity, Reverend Al, there's a new poll out by Civics. You know, there's been this narrative for the last 8 to 10 months that it's African-Americans who have the greatest vaccine hesitancy. It's the African-Americans who are most concerned. But the polling seems to show that it's actually white Republican men who are most resistant to taking the vaccine. Rev, when you're out in the community, when you're speaking to different parts of the National Action Network, do you think that the issue with, in particular, the African-American community getting access to the vaccine, do you think it's more about access to the vaccine or is it actual hesitancy? Because I'm tending to think it's that people just can't get to it more than they're afraid to take it.
It is unquestionably accessibility. There are some that are hesitant, but there are much more, overwhelmingly more, that did not have the access. When we started in National Action Network partnering with Choose Healthy Life, Deborah Frazier House, and others, we were faced with people saying, no, we will take it, but how do we get it? And thankfully, the administration, both nationally and in New York, with the Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, started where even now we have pop-up places starting in Black churches. And all of them are running out of space, Harlem Hospital and others. When I went, it was lines to get my first shot. So I think the question was accessibility. It is no accident white males are hesitant because Donald Trump has told them that in many ways, even though he had got his shot and his wife did as well.
Right. Yeah, it's very interesting that Trump was very much promoting all sorts of ridiculous conspiracy theories, but he and his wife quickly got the vaccine as soon as they could. NBC's Heidi Presbilla live in Philadelphia and Reverend Al Sharpton, thank you all so much for joining me today.
Thank
when
you.
We return, we will remember lives well lived. It was remarkable. After Joyce Virginia Rose passed at the young age of 84, seemed like everybody who phoned up to offer their condolences identified themselves as her best friend. Her niece told us they weren't lying or exaggerating. That's just the type of person Joyce was. A caring, selfless individual, a graceful presence, a fierce friend. She spent her early years on the small Caribbean island of St. Vincent before moving to the U.S. to get her degree. That's when she began arranging for and paying for her family to follow her. Joyce retired in 2002, she traveled the world, and she beat cancer. She volunteered at church and continued to help people whenever she could. That's why she's so missed. Joyce died of the coronavirus a year ago, but the profound effect she had on her friends, family, that's her legacy. And it continues on. We'll be right back. Thank you for spending this hour of Deadline White House with us.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.